Blog Talk Radio.
And greetings, greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. This is the now 209th show of Soul Class in search of ancient authentic Torah, class number 52. And please excuse us, Rabbi Isaac Patton, whose song opens up our show, as we like to do them of the majority of times we make our humble presentations. With Here Comes a Time from his Generation Redemption album. Let's just cue it down. Thank you, Rabbi Isaac. Now, for some reason, we're getting some feedback. Dennis, do you hear that feedback?
Yes, I do, Don.
Yeah, so let's try to, we'll just ask everyone to hold on. Okay, it looks like we lost that feedback. All right, I don't know. I noticed that recently we've been getting some strange feedback mechanisms with our humble efforts here. Let's see if that we can. And we're going to try to fix this. Now, that's not live. That's my voice in a delayed reaction. Let's just. Dennis, hold on, please. Let's try to fix this matter. Hold on, please, for 1 second. Hold on. Okay. Let's see if we fixed it yet. Oh, boy. Listen. Okay, hold on, please. Okay. That's not even me live.
No, it's an old recording, Don.
Well, no, it's actually today's, but for some reason... Okay, let's see how we're doing now. A very strange technicality has occurred, Dennis, for which I cannot answer for. Let's just see here. This is very perplexing here. Let's see what's going on here.
Yes. That was echo of a minute ago.
Yeah. So as I'm talking, I hear something coming over the radio. Let's see now. Do you hear feedback now, Dennis?
No.
Okay. I think what it was is that by virtue of the same speaker that plays the music, it's the same speaker that, because we're connected to my studio, it just projected it. So that was my own glitch. Anyway, as we say, Gamza Latova, that was also for the good. It's part of the learning curve of growing up in this world, even when you're trying to put on a little production as we are. So let's go into our show, and hopefully we won't have any more glitches like that. Blessed is our Creator. Greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We continue to further vibe out on Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, and quote, "And the Lord God said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a helpmate for him," end of quote. As well, we hope to continue to discuss teachings elucidated upon Rambam's views on science, philosophy, and, of course, Torah. Following our discussions about Rambam, we then hope to vibe out on Chabad and Breslov Chassidus, the path of the righteous Gentile, compassion towards humanity in the humanity, not humidity, but towards humanity in the Jewish tradition, plus duties of the heart. Anything live is unpredictable, as we could not predict the fact we'd have that feedback snag a couple moments ago. So please add to what we can predict by listening in and hopefully feeding us with your blessed concerns, comments, and questions to spice up the mix, blessed souls, by calling in at 1-347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may you and your loved ones be written and inscribed in the sweetest year ever, in 5,773 years since original man and woman, Adam and Eve, blessed by the Most High Creator, paved the way for the human family experience. So now we're going to go directly into a letter by the Lubavitcher Rebbe talking about basically the responsibility of the Jewish people to live up to our traditions. And also I'm going to try to evoke out of that a universal message. And of course we'll take feedback from Dennis and anyone else who wants to call in. So this is a letter going back to 1957, which would correspond to the Hebrew year of 5717. And here we go. An objective, unprejudiced survey of the long history of our people will once bring to light that it was not material wealth nor physical strength that helped us survive. Even during the most prosperous times under the united monarchy of King Solomon, the Jewish people and state were materially insignificant by comparison with such contemporary world empires as Egypt, Assyria, and Babylonia, who were existing at that time. That it was not statehood or homeland is clear from the fact that most of the time, by far, our people possessed no independent state and lived in the diaspora. That it was not the language. It is likewise clear from the fact that even in biblical times, Aramaic began to supplant the holy tongue as the spoken language, especially when we were exiled to Babylon, where Aramaic was the primary language. Parts of the scripture and almost all of our Babylonian Talmud and the Zohar, etc., are written in that language, namely Aramaic. In the days of Sadia Gaon, who preceded Maimonides, Rambam, Arabic was the spoken language of most Jews, while later Yiddish and other languages. Nor was it any common secular culture that preserved our people. Does that change radically from one year to another? Dennis, we're just going to hold on and bring in Ron Williams. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, John. Dennis.
Morning, Ron.
Ron, we're in the middle of a letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe for 1957 advocating that the Jewish people reconsider what is truly preserved as a people, and I'm going to try to evoke a universal message for all the blessed children of Noah. We're going to go further into it. Basically, the Rebbe I'm just going to quickly recapitulate it to you in a few words. That basically, it's not the language that has kept our people alive.
It is not the sense of statehood that has kept us alive. It has not been our material bounty that has kept us alive. So let's go further. The one and only common factor which has been present with Jews throughout the ages, in all lands and under all circumstances, is the Torah and the mitzvot, the commandments, which Jews have observed tenaciously in their daily life. To be sure, there rose occasionally dissident groups that attempted to break away from true Judaic teachings, such as the idolatry movements during the first Beis HaMikdash, the Holy Temple, and the Hellenists during the Second Temple period, the Alexandrian assimilationists, the Karaites, which there are groups called, which call themselves Karaites today, but they have disappeared, although there is a faint remnant of Karaitic type of interpretation, which is basically the understanding that it's only the written Torah, which we humbly and yet strongly, and are not shy to say we disagree tremendously with that perspective. Consider without the prejudice, the Torah and mitzvahs must be recognized as the essential thing and essential function of our people, whether for the individual Jew or in relation with the Jewish people to humanity as a whole. Hence the logical conclusion. The policy of imitating the other nations, far from helping preserve the Jewish people, rather endangers its very existence, and instead of gaining their favor, will only intensify their antagonism. In like manner, those Jews who court the favor of non-religious groups' concession and compromise of Torah and mitzvahs not only undermine their own existence and that of our people as a whole by the Torah and the mitzvahs are our very life, but they defeat even their immediate aim, for such a policy only evokes derision and contempt, and justifiably so. For a minor concession today leads to a major one tomorrow, and an evasion of duty towards God leads to an evasion of duty towards man, and who is to say where this downsliding is to stop? At this time, standing as we are on the threshold of the new year, a time propitious for earnest introspection stock taking, I earnestly hope that my brethren everywhere, both as individuals and as groups, and the larger the group, the greater its potentialities and responsibilities, will recognize the reality and truth. The essential factor of our existence and survival is our adherence to the Torah and the practice of its precepts in our everyday life. Let no one delude himself by taking the easy way out, nor by be bribed by temporary advantages and illusory gains. With prayerful wishes for a kesivu kesima tova, meaning to be, everyone should be written and sealed in for a good and pleasant year, good as defined by our Torah, which is truly good, both materially and spiritually, with blessing from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Now, how I want to evoke a universal application is, there's someone else in history who stood out solely as the only person mentioned in the five books of Moses to identify as a tzaddik, as a righteous person, although we've talked about before there were other righteous people mentioned in the five books of Moses. His name was Noah. And it wasn't because of the strength or the might of his craftsmanship as a boat builder or the fact that he had the largest family on the planet. No, it was just him and his wife, Nama, and his three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and their wives. We're talking about, say, eight people who stood up to the entire generation who easily could have overpowered them, and based on their faith in God to build that ark and be prepared for a flood. And at the same time, too, when people would ask Noah, why are you building this boat, this ark, he would reply, because God is going to destroy the earth if you don't change their ways. Well, people didn't want to change their ways. Noah and his wife and his sons and his daughter-in-laws all survived it, and today all of us are that remnant of people who, in fact, did not delude themselves by taking the easier way out or not be bribed by any temporary advantages and illusory gains. Which means, blessed souls, that all of us have this factor within our spiritual, and you can even say physical DNA, because all of us come from Noah and his wife and from the three branches of his sons with the nations that came out of them, the 70 original root nations. So all of us really have that ability to face up to our responsibilities, to put our faith, love, and trust in God, that we can take it to the next level and not be caught up in the euphoria of what has been the last couple of weeks of, say, the Democratic and Republican conventions. Not that I'm anti-politics or anti-Democrat, anti-Republican, but rather we should realize there's still a bigger picture unfolding in the drama of the human family experience, which is that if we invest our first fruit efforts in the Most High, we're going to see much greater results than any promises any political candidate can make. So now we'll turn to our elder statesman, Dennis, for any of his comments, questions, or concerns about what I've just talked about.
Well, first of all, the good rabbi did not write short letters, did he?
No, he didn't. He wrote, there's actually about 30 volumes of voluminous, very large letters, because he, in his wisdom, that there were issues that he would try to cover many details and also bring up ideas that would spur the receiver letter, ideas to contemplate upon.
Well, we call those things missives as opposed to letters, because they're statements of opinion, fact, and comments on the past and the future at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
What I would disagree a little bit, or I have a different viewpoint on from the Lubavitcher rabbi, is that it isn't the Holy Land, it isn't Israel, it isn't the people who are spread out or are all going to come together. I think Judaism today depends on the collective spirit of all Jews. And since they have so much in common, they can think as a group or a collective force. And to me, that's a positive type of thing, because that's what keeps Judaism alive, is the people and their thoughts. So it doesn't matter where they're located. They're basically thinking about the same things. So to me, it's a pleasure to be on the radio today and have an audience that's associated with Judaism or anything else like that, because it's an ongoing struggle that we're facing. So, yes, I agree that regardless of what's going on, the spirit will prevail.
Ron, your take on these matters, the idea that it hasn't been our statehood or our material wealth or even our language, but rather our commitment to the Torah, God's Torah, and the commandments. And maybe let's go back a little bit further back in time, Ron, to Noah, how also we could learn from him how, if one stands on one's principles, one and one's family and the destiny connected to one and one's family can survive the turbulence of the times.
Well, I mean, that episode of Noah speaks for itself, that him and his immediate family were saved from that flood. But I actually like what Dennis just mentioned from a standpoint of what I read this morning, because from today we start reading portions of the Deuteronomy, and in Hebrew it's called Parshas Nitzavim, and it's the portion that's the coming Shabbat. And it says, "You're standing firmly today," and then there's excerpts from the public letter written on Erev Shabbat by the Rebbe, and it says here, you stand firmly today, all of you together before God your God. Jews must stand firm and unshakable, though they are the smallest among all nations. This can only be when they are bound together, united together, all of you. How is it possible to form a true enduring union of different individuals with different ideas, different interests, and different aspirations? The answer is, before God, your God. The union of all Jews is possible because, as a matter of fact, they are already united by virtue of their soul, which is actually a part of God above, and which is found in every Jew without exception. An all-profound reflection that you stand before God, who is your God, your strength, your life. You must bring forth and actualize this union of one with another, and of individual and with community of our people in the fullest measure. So it matters not where you stand, as long as you stand before God.
That's right.
Because we all bear that divine image. And as you said before, the elections right now, you know, many people get all caught up in this wave of who's going to be the next, the best president, the right president. I mean, we're allowed to have these aspirations, but we must still remember that everything is in the hand of the Creator, and salvation comes from Him. He uses whatever vessel He chooses to use. So instead of focusing on the individual as a means of salvation, we have to look at the actual Redeemer, which is the Creator, who will help us. And we have to also behave in a way that is worthy of being saved. We can't just decide to do whatever we want, to do live however we want, and expect that, you know, oh, by just electing a certain president or a certain party, you know, everything in America will suddenly be changed for the good. We have to take that step as individuals, as communities, and the entire country. So, and, you know, it's happening now at the time of this month, the month of September, which is the month right before the New Year. And the New Year, I must remind everyone, it's not Rosh Hashanah, it's not a Jewish New Year. Actually, Rosh Hashanah is celebrated on the day that Adam was created, and at that point in time, this is the entire human race. And the Creator sits in judgment, and he distributes basically what our needs for the rest of the year on this in this time on Rosh Hashanah. And if we're looking forward to a better year, regardless of whatever parties in Congress or whatever it is, we have to ultimately do our best to be deserving of what's to come for the next year, given out by the Creator and not by whichever party we vote for. So that's my take on what you just mentioned.
True. Just two points I want to touch on. Number one, maybe I misunderstood you, Dennis, but I don't think from the Rebbe's letter that he was predicating anything about the Jews right now returning in whole to the Holy Land, and it's more about as Ron mentioned, because the whole earth is filled with the Most High's glory. And the truth is, the vast majority of our history has been living outside the land. But that being said, I just want to mention, clarify, I am not a Zionist. I am not a religious Zionist, nor do I believe, based on the traditions we received through the Lubavitcher, that the beginning of the Zionist state of Israel was the beginning of the redemption, because it contradicts very basic teachings about how the land of Israel is to be settled, even made war over. And I publicly come out against any type of what I call boogeyman Judaic teachings, where teachers, even scholars, even rabbis have come out and sort of made threatening remarks to Jews living in diaspora. Oh, if you don't come back to Israel now, who knows what's going to happen in these lands that are outside the Israel. We thoroughly, thoroughly reject this type of ideology, because the only one who can make this type of projection of what will happen to world Jewry, whether it be in the land of Israel, outside the diaspora, are prophets. And I haven't seen anyone who has made these pronouncements being proclaimed by either themselves, which most people won't proclaim themselves as prophets, except those people who are sitting in psychiatric wards, unfortunately, or by others. And so, therefore, I come to affirm the idea that the whole idea is that following God's word, as we humbly suggest to the world, and share with the world, is that this is according to the written and oral traditions of the Torah. This is what we're following. And in fact, there was the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson, with the same name as the Rebbe of this generation, the seventh Rebbe, may his merits protect us, was approached by one of Hasidim that had a tremendous thirst to make what we call Aliyah, to ascend to the land of Israel. And so the Tzemek Tzedek told him, Rebbe Menachem Schneerson, the third Rebbe, said, I'll say it in Yiddish, Mach da Eretz Israel, make here Israel, meaning we define Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, as not just the physical dimensions of the land, but actually a place where Torah is learned, commandments are fulfilled, and wisdom is being taken in by human beings to the point where they increase their love and fear of God. Because truly, when all cylinders are working for the land of Israel, as they were in the time of, say, Solomon, during that brief 40-year period, then the masses of human beings, the children of Noah, used to come to consult with King Solomon. And that's what we see when the King Messiah comes, the Mashiach comes. And by the way, I want to mention something about an expression of Jewish unity, but this is something really open to all human beings. 3 days before Yom Kippur, which I don't have on my calendar right in front of me, maybe next week's show we'll talk about it. 3 days before Yom Kippur, at about 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Jews all around the world are going to make a general prayer to Almighty God to send the Mashiach. Because it's brought down in sources that if the Israelite people were to ask for Mashiach at one moment, we want Mashiach to come and we want the world to be filled with mercies, Almighty God could not refuse us. Now, The practical logistics of it, we probably won't get everyone. It would like I'd like to say in a very euphoric fashion that we'll get everyone to say it. Probably not, but still, hopefully this will imbue a consciousness and spread a consciousness in the world tantamount to the butterfly effect, which hopefully we might talk about a little bit later, which will spread this idea that we need the prophets or prophetic spirit to return to the earth to be engaged in fixing the earth. And Rambam himself mentions that even before the coming of the Mashiach, the Messiah, we will not be surprised when prophetic spirit starts to be poured upon the more elevated members of the human family experience, which is not just Jewish people, that all peoples who are privy via their learning and their prayers and their acts of kindness will be privy to the Ruach HaKodesh, the divine inspiration, to help inspire and lead us, hopefully, in a pleasant and peaceful manner. I'm sure Dennis has something to say about that as well. Dennis.
I think you sort of reflected on what I referred to, and that is the collective spiritual mind of all Jews is basically in the same place. And the place is not a physical place on the planet. It's the collective spirituality that's there. And it does make a difference, as well as other religions that try to practice that spiritual collectivism that's there. In other words, if you know what the truth is and what is good, and you have faith, belief, and trust, you will keep on doing that. And that is your answer to the future and to survival or salvation or redemption, whatever you want to call it. Because if you know you're right and you stick to it, you will be rewarded.
True. And then, but I just, you know, now you throw the ball, you threw the ball to my court, I'm going to throw the ball to Ron's court, and maybe he'll throw it to you. But I say, Dennis, as well, it's not just about the Jewish people. It's about all the children of Noah of the world, which I do believe have a collective consciousness. Now, maybe in their subconscious in some levels, but I think in many, many of the peoples of the world, there is a collective revealed consciousness. We must change this world to become a settled place in fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy. The world was created to be a settled place. And it matters not to me if they know about that verse or not. I think the majority of the people, and we see it, it's in the Middle East, it's in Africa, it's in America, it's in South America. Now, there's a disagreement of the means to this end of making this world a settled place. But Ron, what do you think? Do you agree with me, or you can disagree as well, that I think the B'nai Noach, the children of Noah, whether they're conscious of it in an open way or they're subconsciously aware, really want to see that change towards making this a settled world?
Oh, gosh, definitely. I mean, one of the moves we made was, you know, creating the United Nations, which was supposed to work, in which we build this organization which is supposed to oversee, like, all the nations of the world. That's one reason why we all send, you know, representatives to that union, and they were supposed to oversee the entire world in a peaceful, pleasant manner. It was a good idea. Just not implemented well. And then, you know, politics, of course, you know, we all know what that leads to. But I think that was an effort we made to kind of bring stability to the world, settledness to the world, where, you know, nation would just rise up and swallow another nation with no consequences. You know, so I think that was one of our steps towards that type of settling of the world. And we see that countries where there's bounty, people kind of go to that country, because in a country where man, given their material needs, they're more at peace with themselves or each other. And, you know, I think, I don't know, that's how I feel. And
so,
one of the things, when I spoke to Rabbi Markel, Yossi Markel, I met by you, Don, by the way, he said mm-hmm. that in America, one of the reasons why people from all nations can come here and they feel a sense of their identity, which their nationhood, the identity of each nation is, it's a pretty overstep another, because no one really ultimately belonged in this land to begin. It wasn't given. When the lands were parceled out to Noah's three sons, North and South America were not really part of that land.
Mm-hmm.
because Ham was given the African, the continent, the European continent, the African, the whole Middle Eastern, the continent of Asia, basically to Shem, and the North and South Americas, maybe were attached at the time, but nevertheless have been separated. And we all come here, we try to start a new era, because, you know, what we've seen in Europe and in Africa and other countries, and we come to the Americas for a kind of a freedom, and many things done here was an improvement to what was done back in the old continent, the you know, the, you know, measure the world third, fourth continent. So,
Dennis, your take on Ron's perceptions and
that's a good one, but I love God, but I have faith in my fellow human beings. Why? Because I don't believe God created any evil person, per se. Not as a human. As a devil, who knows? I don't know about that part. But I do know when creation occurs and recreation occurs, it's a good thing. It's a positive thing. And people are not necessarily born evil or bad. They may have problems that cause disruptions and other things. But I have my faith in the fellow man that eventually we will come together and we will be together.
Amen.
Can I just say one thing here, Dennis? I really think you should go, you know, I would definitely vote for you for president.
They would probably shoot me before I'd get a chance.
God forbid. Okay, gentlemen, I'd like to move on to our next section of Maimonides, but before we get to Dennis reading a section from Moses Maimonides, Physician, Scientist, and Philosopher, I came upon a quote by the Rambam that was shared on Facebook by Blessed Brother Amos Presley. He's down south. I forgot if he's in the Carolinas or south of the Carolinas, or if he's living in Tennessee, but I'd like to, I've never ran across this quote by Rambam, and I've been learning Rambam all probably about 26 years now, but maybe you'll recognize this quote, Dennis, and if you do, if you can elaborate, and then maybe we'll get some feedback on as well. Here it goes, a very brief quote. It goes like this. Maimonides teaches, truth does not become more true by virtue of the fact that the entire world agrees with it, nor less so even if the whole world disagrees with it. End of quote. Dennis, your take on that, and do you recognize that as a teaching from the Guide to the Perplexed or any other places you've learned about Rambam?
Yes, I do. That's a reoccurring theme, because if you have truth, you really can't add to it. It is what it is, and you can only go so far in your mind as to how close you can be to God. It cannot really happen on an absolute basis because we're not perfect. But we strive to be the best that we can be and the best that God can accept us for what we are. So therefore, what we do, our actions are going to be judged, not our intentions. And I just lost the train of thought I was on, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay, Ron, let me read that quote again for you. Truth does not become more true by virtue of the fact that the entire world agrees with it, nor less, so even if the whole world disagrees with it. Your take on that teaching from Rambam.
I would like to answer that with another statement, that we should not add or subtract to the Torah. That means, my understanding is we can't add to something that is already true and make it more true. And subtracting from it does not diminish the value of its truth. And to me, that thing is, people can come up with their own ideas, and not because you have the multitude on your side, that means the truth. The nation that were witnesses of the giving of the Torah, that nation does not happen to be the largest nation in the world, but nevertheless, it carries that truth of the Torah with it. So, if by virtue of the truth, by virtue of the numbers, we assess the value of truth, then we would totally disavow the entire Ten Commandments.
Beautiful. Okay, with that being said,
Don,
if you could... Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
the thought just came to me again, was that when Mayamati said that, he was basically referring to the individual, that if you believe and have the faith and the trust of what you think is good, don't be deterred. Continue on that route. It doesn't matter if people agree with you or not. If you believe in what you're doing is correct, maybe it will rub off to the other people by your actions.
Beautiful. Dennis, if we can turn now to Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, philosopher, edited by Dr. Fred Rosner and Dr. Samuel S. Kotek, we would greatly appreciate your reading for us now.
Okay, what we have is on page 173, Don.
173, okay, I'm going...
Oh, it's 136.
136, okay.
136, and it's put together by a fellow by the name of Reuben P. Bulka. He happens to be a rabbi doctor from Ottawa, Canada, and he's...
Uh-huh.
Founder and editor of the Journal of Psychology and Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So let me begin here.
Take it away.
Okay. It says, if philosophers are to be helpful in clinical situations, they must be modern 20th century philosophers. Pure philosophers can be of help in a clinical situation through their own philosophical approach. But philosophers who provide insight into psychology of how a human being behaves or should behave can speak to the modern situation even if they lived long before the 20th century. In this vein, it is instructive to study some of the views of Moses Maimonides, outstanding Jewish philosopher, to explore possible insights that Maimonides' philosophy may offer for the health model in psychology. In the second chapter of the first part of The Guide to the Perplexed, Maimonides describes a question which was posed to him concerning the first human beings before and after they ate from the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. Scripture states that after Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, they, through them, all mankind, were granted the capacity to know and good evil. In the words of Maimonides, quote, it does not appear strange that the punishment...
I think it said it does appear, Dennis. You said it does not.
I said it does not?
Yeah.
Okay, yes, sorry. It does appear that the punishment for rebelliousness should be the means of the... hang on one second. Doesn't it appear this should be the... elevating man to a pinnacle of perfection to which he had not attained previously, end quote. If Adam and Eve were heretofore unable to distinguish between good and evil, their having disobeyed God's command resulted in the elevation of the capacity to distinguish between good and evil, it hardly seems congruous that because one behaves in a wrong manner, one is rewarded. The gist of Maimonides' response to the question is that before their disobedience, Adam and Eve were able to distinguish between true and false, between the emet and the sheker. Afterwards, the capacity to make the distinction was not elevated. It was reduced so that they were only able to discern the difference between good and evil, tov and ra. In other words, Adam and Eve previously possessed a perfect and a complete intellectual capacity, which became compromised by their subsequent disobedience. What is the primary difference between true false and good evil? The dimension of true false concerns itself with absolute values, where the dimension of good evil with relative values. In determining what is true and what is false, one deals with objective reality. Maimonides himself points out, with regard to the statement that the earth is flat, that it is not appropriate to employ the terms good and bad. Either the earth is flat or it is not, in which the case of the statement is either true or false. Before Adam and Eve's disobedience, all values were clearly in the category of true-false. Since matters were perceived in terms of objective truth, values were not subjective, but rather objective realities. Once Adam and Eve submitted to interest, with Eve seeing the fruit was attractive and anticipating, that would be quite easy. They introduced a new factor into human confrontation with reality. The factor was the capacity to reduce, therefore, objective truths to relative values, values subject to compromise. Judging whether a behavior was desirable or not was now reduced to whether it was good or bad, not true or false. The woman saw that the tree was good for food, Genesis 3:6, and then ate from it. Although the terms objective and subjective truths are used, Maimonides, in making the distinction between good, evil, true, false, speaks about a difference between the apparent truth and the necessary truth. The objective, subjective paradigm seems to correlate quite accurately with the Maimonidean distinction.
Okay, very nice. Now, it's funny, Dennis. Well, it's not funny. It's a matter of synchronicity. Synchronicity, which was a term by, I think, Carl Jung, which found its way into a song by Sting of the Police. And also a matter of Ashoka Prata's divine providence that you're bringing this topic up, because we hope to be connecting to these ideas at the end of the show when we talk about chapter 2, verse 18 in Genesis. The idea of objective perspective of the human being as opposed to the subjective. Now, from what I understand, that the problem that resulted in the Garden of Eden was that Adam and Eve, before they should have internalized, that before they look at anything, they must take the greater perspective, the greater objective, meaning everything is good solely from the Almighty, as opposed to let us try to interpret what is good. Even after the fact, we were told by the Almighty what is good for us and what is bad for us. I mean, nothing is good or bad for the Almighty, because he's beyond good or bad. He's beyond truth and falsehood. So this raises, hopefully, on the part of those listening in, this very interesting dynamic, and perhaps it might create a sense of intellectual tension for some people to start to get into the realm of meditation. How do I balance what is true and false as it relates to good and evil? So Ron, what is your take on this? The difference between perhaps it might be an intellectual tension for some people of truthhood and falsehood and good and evil, and perhaps people just threw it into the same package of intellectual meditation or consciousness. Ron?
I'm still digesting what I just heard from Dennis reading.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't quite put together a response.
Okay, so let's go right to Dennis. The idea, do you think that some people are, or maybe many people, are not aware of the fact that there is a slight difference between truth and falsehood and good and evil? And as I would humbly suggest, based on what I've learned, and hopefully will be covered in the teachings later on the show, that good and evil is coming from the more objective perspective, and I'm sorry, truth and falsehood. The truth is we should realize that to be truly objective in the truth, we have to connect to God's truth.
Well,
not any other truth, and any other truth below God is going to have some element of falsehood in relation to God's truth. It doesn't necessarily a bad falsehood, but it's a little bit of shining of subjectivity within ourselves, trying to interpret the objective reality that everything is, all is God, and God is everything.
Well, God gave us an intellect, and with that intellect, a free will. And humans me included, all humans,
all of us,
like to rationalize. And when we rationalize, that's sometimes when we get into trouble, because are we splitting hairs? Are we turning it around and say, if you rotate it 90 degrees, it's really a different subject matter? Are we trying to get away from the hard black and white and create more gray area? So this is the difference of being an objective or a subjective thinker, or somebody who says, well, it's not exactly black and white. Well, is it good, evil, true, false? Either one, you're trying to create an in-between category with your rationalization. If you try to do that, are you really feeling, like Don said, that you're causing a mental problem or mental stress or strain that you have to make a clear decision that you have to live with? I mean, you can interpret it and say, well, it's good for others, but it's not good for me. We rationalize all the time. So the question is, how objective can you be, or how subjective do you want to be? The easier way to go with it is to be subjective, because then you have a certain amount of sympathy involved, and you feel better that I didn't have to make a clear decision, but I think I went the right way. Well, you can hem and haw all you want. It's clear. You know right from wrong. We cannot quibble about that.
True. I would like to suggest, and maybe we'll turn back to Ron, and if he doesn't want to comment, we'll move on to the next section concerning Rambam, that I think the power of one's ability to be objective, even though by nature that we are truly subjective conscious beings, and I'm not saying that in a negative sense, that's just only the Most High is truly objective. I think the more objective we are is, I think, a testimony to the amount of humility that a person can internalize within his or her lifestyle. Because, again, no matter what I can understand, I must realize it's only according to my perception of what I think is objective reality. And I had a friend who, for many years, we used to learn together in the Frankel Shul here in Crown Heights. Very, very brilliant young man. His name is Menachem Klein, very well versed in Chinese medicine and massage therapy, and very much into the sciences. He used to remind us when we would come into a very difficult part of our Hasidic teachings, which we would do on Shabbos, is that consider the spectrum of light. Now, true light is not of any color. It's more relating to a revelation. But when we codify, say, a spectrum of light, say like we push light or we direct light through a prism, we see certain colors which we can identify, but yet there are more colors that are being refracted through the prism that we don't see. Now, if we cannot humble ourselves to that very simple fact in terms of the concept of revelation, like let's say in the revelation of consciousness, that whatever we're conscious of, we're still much more unconscious of that which we are not aware of about any particular matter, and even about God and his teachings, divine teachings, or people. So I always thought that has served as probably one of the most potent allegories to remind myself I have to try to stay humble, because I don't see the entire color of the color spectrum of light. Ron or Dennis, any comments on that?
There's an axiom to that thing you were just talking about, Don. And that is rainbows. We all can see rainbows, but rainbows don't exist where we see them. Rainbows exist in our eye because we have a conic construction in our eye that spreads out the color. We know animals do not have this conic construction within the eye. So what happens is when you see a rainbow, you are creating it yourself in your own eye, and you swear you're looking at it. Of course you are, because it's in your eye, and we all accept what our eyes see because we call that a fact. But in fact, it's an internal conic construction that's causing a dispersion within our eyes. So the rainbow that you see is not really there because it's in your eye.
Very true. And let's not forget the fact, if there was no light shining upon us, we wouldn't see one thing at all because of the refractive nature of light to generate our ability to see. I mean, this is something I learned many years ago. And Ron, what's your take on this, that the amount of objectivity of a person is intimately connected to their humility to realize whatever perspective or conscience they are gaining day by day, year by year, decade by decade, it must be balanced by the fact, this humble person, that they don't still have the whole picture of anything, even though they've been learning it for many years.
That's that's my advice normally whenever people jump to conclusions or make certain judgments, and even including myself. I learned the painful truth about that many times it's only because of our perception due to the way in which we were brought up or how we are geared as people, as individuals, to see certain things that we make certain judgments. And I've learned, in the past that many times we see things only because of the situation that we're in or the emotional state that we're in. And as a result, our truth, our personal truth is very, very subjective. And what we have to do is always consult with another, because many times, and a person is not in the same situation as we are, they can see things a little bit more objectively. It's not the most pleasant situation. Most people would rather not, because it's not a very pleasant situation to be in. That's why most of the time your best friends are the ones who tell you the painful truth. And I find myself now leaning towards that direction, because many times we feel a certain way only because of certain stimulations that we have due to the past or how we're basically wired as a person. And we need others to remind us sometimes of our shortcomings and flaws that we may possess that's causing us to see things a certain way. And when it comes to Torah, many times I run things by you all the time just to hear your perspective and coming from your wisdom and understanding. And from there I can gather more or less if I've been on the right track or if I've been off. So definitely require that ingredient of humility, because once you consult with another, you're already putting your ideas at the point, at the level where it's subjected to criticism by another, and that requires humility. So that's my take.
Dennis and Ron and Dennis, we have another caller. It's either Roger Oberlin of Alliance, Ohio, or Dr. Abraham of California. Caller, can you please identify yourself?
Yes, Don, it is Abraham, California. How are you?
Good morning, Abraham, and I don't know how much you've heard. By the way, Abraham, we have Dennis Ryan on the line, who you had discourse with before, and, of course, Ron Williams.
Hi, Abraham.
The idea of, you're a practicing physician, Abraham. Now, have you seen how the objective perspective as a physician is empowered by humility, or have you seen doctors where they've kind of like gone in a tohu, a chaotic way of pushing their viewpoint, and how it's actually it's caused problems, whether it be in the operating room or in medical practice?
I wasn't thinking along those lines. I'm sure that is would be a factor to certainly humility. Not having humility in the field of medicine will get you into trouble very quickly. If one is arrogant, certainly about having a closed-minded approach to how one manages patients. The discussion I think you're having today about the objectivity of truth or versus falsehood and how it relates to good and evil is very profound and is an extensive philosophical discussion. I don't know if this is helpful, but I have a very famous quote from Albert Einstein that does touch on somewhat of what you said regarding humility and the ability to distinguish
and the human ability to distinguish truth versus falsehood. Is it possible I can read it for a moment?
Sure.
Okay, this is a very, it's easily resourced on the internet. And he wrote this in the 1950s in communication to a couple of people, but the one was a gentleman whose son had recently died from polio. And it goes as follows. Quote, "A human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the beauty of nature in its and the whole of nature in its beauty." I think this relates directly to what you're saying, that what we perceive as humans as being true is not necessarily the case, because we have a very limited ability to perceive, quote-unquote, the truth. And one needs to be humble enough to recognize that limitation.
True. Thank you very much, Avram. Dennis, any takes on that?
Well, I have a corollary to that, and that is that a very wise man was asked years ago say, what is the definition of a smart human being? And he said, it's a person who's aware of what they don't know.
Yeah. You know what the Rambam says, Dennis? I'm unfortunately, I don't remember the source, is that he mentions after a person has learned all there is to know from the Torah, they go back to square and saying, I know nothing. Meaning, a person who you would think would be filled with the praises of everyone and maybe start to feel a sense of self-aggrandizement should humble him, saying, you know what, after I've learned all this, I really know nothing, and start the process of learning again. So perhaps they'll come to be able to say the next time they go through the next cycle of learning what is known to be the entire Torah, which is including all the oral and traditions, including Talmudic texts and Jewish law texts, that they'll say, I truly know nothing, but at least I know perhaps a little bit more. In my knowing nothing, I know a little bit more than I used to know when I really didn't know nothing at all. So it's just, there's this dimension of struggle within our consciousness, which is, again, coming out of that original mistake or sin, you might want to call coming out of the Garden of Eden, which hopefully we'll talk about in future broadcasts, where there's the tension between, you know, realizing it's all about God and, well, if it's all about God, how do I understand it in my own particular way? Because we were created to have a subjective perspective of the objective reality, which is all about God, but in a way that hopefully, as human beings, as what I like to call the human family experience, everyone will put forth their puzzle that will fit the framework that God has created for the creation. Ron, would you like to chime in on this?
It's funny that man has to learn, acquire knowledge, and then he understands that he hasn't acquired anything at all. It's a very paradoxical, and it just shows that whoever tries to display their knowledge, many times you see that they're the ones who actually lack knowledge. But some people who try to display knowledge, they actually acquire more knowledge because their display evokes others to also relate what they've learned. And it can be a very pleasant sharing atmosphere in some circumstances.
Ron?
Hello?
Ron? Yeah, it sounded like we lost you for a second.
All right, let's we'll continue.
Okay, I'd like to add feedback. If you're not finished, Ron, please continue. If not, I want to share something from Roger Oberlin, who is listening into the show, and he has some very pungent commentary based on our discussion, gentlemen, and blessed souls listening out there. Ron, do you want to add to it, or I should read something from Roger?
Please continue.
Okay. So Roger Oberlin of Alliance, Ohio, wrote the following to me, and I want to share it with you, with everyone. Sometimes we are not even quote-unquote here. That wooden door you see day after day is made up of electrical energy, as our own bodies, everything in this physical world, is given to us by God. Even the rainbow we see, if you dig into the physics, we don't even exist. Lots of love. The universe is all energy provided to us and sustained by God. Amen. That we know nothing. Now, I just want to mention that this philosophical question of whether we really exist or not was actually something which the fourth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Shmuel Schneerson of Lubavitch, contemplated upon. Do we truly exist as human beings or not? So in the end, he wrote that we do exist by virtue of one verse in the Torah, which says, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. So by virtue of the fact that we are identified as beings that were created by none other but the one who created heaven and earth, but we do have a tangible existence, but our sense of self-nullification can testify ultimately to a consciousness that we are nothing before him, or, unfortunately, on the negative side, we can have an arrogant position that we are truly something to the exclusion of the objective godly consciousness, so then we're truly nothing because we're rejecting the objectivity of everything is truly, you know, in the realm of the Most High's providence that we should be alive. Jeremiah, I'd like to read just a brief little historical background on the Rambam as a follow-up to what Dennis mentioned, not necessarily connected directly, but just I want to give everyone we've got like almost 100 pages of historical background on Rambam, which I think will help arouse more people to learn more about this great sage and great contributor to human consciousness. So this is from a book called The Teachings of Maimonides from Jacob S. Mincon, which reads the following. The Moors, who were the Mohammedan conquerors of Spain, they were of the Islamic faith, were not religious fanatics. They were too young to be intolerant and too busy and ambitious to be bigoted. They were strong in their faith, both generous regard to the religious convictions of others. Their hearts were set on conquest and not on conversion. When therefore the Jews and Moors had met on the banks of the, I don't know if I'm going to do justice to this word, Guadalquivir, they met as friends and not as enemies. The Moors had long since forgotten their old grievance against the Jews, which constituted the fact that they forgot the prophet's complaint that in the early days of his ministry, meaning as the Muslims would call him the prophet Muhammad, the Jews had rejected his blandishments, would not accept his faith, and even made fun of his revelations. What the Moors remembered was that the Jews and the Arabs were in fact cousins, that through Ishmael they traced their origin back to the common ancestry of Abraham. The Moors were flattered by the kinship, and they showed their appreciation by a friendly relationship with the Jews, which lasted for nearly 500 years. Which brings me to a point I want to share, and I don't want to get political or anti-religious, but I just want to bring out something about something I learned this previous week about the concept of little jihad versus the big jihad. The big jihad is the conquering of oneself, and it's the little jihad which has resulted in many wars and the conflagrations that are taking place right now in the Middle East, not Arab against Jew, but actually Arab against Arab. And we just want to kindly invoke a blessing that our cousins, our common ancestry in Abraham, through the seed of Ishmael, will hear this message somehow on a conscious or subconscious level. Please hearken back to the time of the Moors, your ancestors as well, spiritually speaking, and be tolerant of yourselves, be tolerant of others, that there's enough room for all of us in the Middle East or any other place in the world. And please remember the big jihad is conquering oneself, and the little jihad should be put on the shelf. And let the Mashiach come back. Let the Christian Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus, whatever you want to call him, or Muhammad come back, and we can settle down to the table of international meditation to settle out our means, which hopefully will be a universal means, whether it be of the Noahide faith or of the Judaic faith. So that perhaps might be a little bit polemic in nature, but let's just go around the table. Dennis, your take on my statement first on the historical background of what Rambam emerged from, and any hopes or blessings you want to invoke upon the world now.
There's a historical correction to be added there, Don. when the Moors, they were the Almohades tribe of North Africa, took over the Iberian Peninsula, or most of it, they were very, very tolerant. But that's the atmosphere that the Maimonides was born in. However, by the time he was a teenager, a late teenager, a different group overthrew the friendly, nice people called the Almohades, and extremists took over. At that point, they said, either you join us or you can lose your head, or we will put you in prison until you agree to go along with our religious thinking. So they became very, very intolerant. Ergo, the grandma and his family decided to move to North Africa, hoping to get away from this oppressive type of society. So, yes, it started off on a good footing, but the extremists came in and took over. And it was the same tribe, the Almohades, and they made life almost miserable. Well, it was miserable. However, except that we can all come back together again, yes, we have roots. We all have roots that goes back to Moses. We cannot forget that. Moses recognized by most formal religions in some way, shape, or form, especially Western civilization and part of Eastern civilization. But we do have a lot in common. However, we do not emphasize that anymore. We do not bring that up. We now look at our differences, and our differences look like, how can we ever get back to where we were together?
True. That, Dennis, you brought a very good point. Yes, eventually the tranquility that Rambam and his family enjoyed in Cordova would come to an abrupt end by the time he was 13. Hopefully next week's show we'll cover that. Abraham or Ron, would you like to chime in on these thoughts? Or feedback, comments, concerns?
I think the message that you're sending out over the public broadcast is very brave regarding so-called "can't we all get along" message. I hope there are people listening to you, put it that way.
Well, I'll tell you where my bravery comes from, Avram. It's prophetic teachings from the Tanakh, which talk about eventually Egypt, which, let's take it as a symbol for the entire Arabian Peninsula, even though Egypt geographically is in North Africa, that eventually all the peoples of the Middle East, as well as the rest of the world, shall serve God with one accord. So I'm trying to see the trees beyond the confrontational. I'm trying to see the forest, I should say, the universal forest beyond the confrontational trees. Ron, any take on this matter?
I read once a statement. Maybe you can help me with the source of it. Where a king had just came back from a great war, which he'd won. And he met the sage, and the sage said, "You've just actually finished a small battle. The larger battle now is the one where you're conquering yourself." So we see many times, you know, people can go out and they can do great things, but yet they still can't achieve that that inner tranquility, that inner peace within themselves. You can go out many times and you can profess, you know, people should get along with each other, but even within yourself, you have that constant battle in which you can't bring under control. So many times, as you said, the big jihad, that's the one that is necessary, which we conquer ourselves, our inclinations, our negativity. So I agree with that 100%.
Okay. With that being said, gentlemen, and bless those. Yes, Dennis.
Quick interruption here regarding what Avram is saying. And that is that years ago I did an analysis between Islamic thinking, Christian thinking, and Judaic thinking. And I said, what is the difference between these three different groups? And you know what? All the differences I found were created by humans. Can't we undo what humans have done?
Well, I think we can. It's going to take a lot of effort, and that's why we're making our little molecular efforts here through cyberspace to try to transmit this idea to hopefully spark within the mind of another person, who every person has a divine image, which is connected to the human intellect, to hopefully consider these words and bring it up in discussion with other people. And as I mentioned before at the beginning of the show, hopefully we'll have a spiritual and a physical butterfly effect, that the confrontational trees will give way to the universal forest of human unity, unified, of course, in the one creator. With that being said, gentlemen, and blessed souls listening out there, I'd like to turn to a song. We're past the midway point, but I think it's a song that is kind of fitting for the times we're in, that no matter how much euphoric reactions we're seeing in the media now, whether it be about matters in Africa, the Middle East, America with the political elections coming up in November, there's still a level of consciousness which I think was fantastically captured by a song by the Beatles written by George Harrison. Maybe we'll vibe out on that for a couple minutes before we move on to the other segment of the show. It's a song called Why My Guitar Gently Weeps, talking about while this person is jamming out, he's seeing that still there's something wrong in the human condition. And let the words of the song arouse in your mind this type of perception, and then maybe we'll talk about it for a couple minutes. Here we go. This is While My Guitar Gently Weeps. It was composed as a group by the Beatles, but in particular by George Harrison. Please hold on for the next 4 minutes and 46 seconds. There's something wrong in the human condition. Let the words of the song arouse in your mind this type of perception, and maybe we'll talk about it for a couple minutes. Here we go. This is While My Guitar Gently Weeps. It was composed as a group by the Beatles, but in particular by George Harrison. Please hold on for the next 4 minutes and 46 seconds. About that, we're just going to cut away from the song. I have to forget why this week I'm getting such horrible technical feedback to distort the song, and well, I'm sorry about that. But anyway, the song was about how George Harrison was perceiving that he's jamming along, and I see that people are sleeping, and they're being bought and sold, and they're being perverted and diverted. But, you know, there's a certain flow of consciousness which is actually experienced in the world of music, and the world of music is empowered by a sort of surging and retreating, the surging of sound in consciousness, the silence that is between each sound of the song being sung. So, Dennis or Avraham and Ron, I apologize again to you all personally for that static distortion there. Getting feedback. Hopefully we'll work it out before the next show. Dennis, this idea of, you know, there's a constant surging and retreating of consciousness, not just within the musical world, but within the angelic and world of God, which is only known unto him, while, so to speak, the world's sleeping. Your take on this concept?
The concept is embedded in our minds as to what level of spirituality is there. You cannot ignore it because you can't explain everything. So therefore, you must have a faith or belief in something other than what you're physically experiencing, because your mind is much bigger than your physical world. So anybody who has creative thoughts has to include what's in their head. And there is a level of spirituality. Sometimes it comes, sometimes it goes, but we cannot ignore it because we can't answer all our questions about the earth and about God. So therefore, we fill it in with a poem, a song, or even different types of literature, because that's what the human spirit needs, is a little bump of spirituality.
Ron, what's your take on these matters?
I really don't have anything together right now to say.
Okay. Avraham?
Yes, sir. I think the lyrics of that of the tune, of which I'm very familiar with, are very profound. And the question of spirituality and the ability to be quote unquote spiritual, I think, does arise from a questioning mind that does not simply accept so-called beliefs, but from a mind that is capable and willing to question everything. And it's only once one does that and then comes to the realization that one is in fact very limited, that one is able to quite easily and freely become a so-called spiritual person. And I think ultimately that's what many so-called scientists are realizing, that the limits of their understanding of objective science, as it's called, is very limited, and they become they become themselves very spiritually oriented.
I hear you. I hear you. And I think did we quote it on this show or someplace else? Maybe it was on this show several shows ago, that Einstein said himself, going back to Albert Einstein, that he said that the more one engages in the study or the application of science, the one begins to, I'm trying to remember the words exactly, to believe in God. Not know God, but to believe in God. Now, with that being said, too, that, you know, what he struggled was with quantum field mechanics or physics, whatever it might be called exactly. And that, so, you know, again, that gets down back to that basic issue, is that as great a mind, as objective a mind that Einstein was, to come up with the theory of relativity, and relativity is something which also hopefully we're going to relate to in the verse in 2:18 in Genesis, it's still not sufficient to have a relative consciousness, that still we have to, the relativity that is really truly positive, well, I would say not, it can be in the scenario of a truly positive growing consciousness, is that our humble admission that everything we perceive is relative to our human perception. Therefore, there's still a realm of the perception of that reality, which is still leaps and bounds beyond our perceptions. And therefore, we take a step back to realize, well, maybe I'll share this idea, as I tried to do, like on today's show, with Dennis and Avraham and Ron. And hopefully what happens is, again, we're all offering our little pieces to the puzzle, which are hopefully within the framework of what God would expect of us in this discourse on this Sunday morning.
Don?
Yes.
All scientists use mathematics as their working tool. And in mathematics, we have a concept called infinity. It's something that we don't know what it is, but we created a symbol to represent it. However, it's included in a lot of equations. Now, if you start thinking about infinity, you're going to start expanding your mind at a very fast rate. So you have to delve into or start bumping into spiritual things, because we have nothing that can handle the whole world that's infinite. So we're into a different dimension. And just to point out a practical idea of this is that there used to be a game that mathematicians used to play, and they'd say, tell me what is the greatest number in the world, and I'll show you a better one. And whatever number you say, all you have to say, respond to is add one to it.
Very good, Dennis. We're going to move on, gentlemen, to a book based on the teaching. Well, it is teachings directly from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, which last week we started this portion of the show, and it's several hundred pages, so we're not going anywhere. Actually, it's several hundred pages. And we're not going anywhere quick with this, because the concept to be discussed is the concept of something in Hebrew called Erech HaPayim, which is literally meaning long in anger, but it's related to the human characteristic, which hopefully all of us are practicing on a daily basis, And we can only pray that we should practice on a moment-by-moment basis, because we all lose it occasionally. The concept of savlanut, or savlanut, patience. So here's a teaching from Rabbi Nachman we're going to briefly go into, and run around the table of discussion with our three co-hosts today. Therefore, a person should be able to bear everything, and to believe that everything is for the goodness of that of himself or herself. For anyone that is serving the Most High is serving him for goodness, which means to run in each situation or any situation to the Creator may be blessed, and to his Torah, as we humbly suggest, as members of the children of Israel, to all human beings, and to pray and to supplicate before him in a language that a person is accustomed to. Meaning you don't have to pray in my language, and I don't have to pray in your language. You pray in a language that you are best suited to communicate to the Creator. And this type of prayer is called hisbodudus, meaning secluding oneself, not necessarily in a physical sense, but setting a space in your mind that you know in any situation where you have to turn to the Most High, you can openly and freely access this level of consciousness to have a conversation in your mind. Now, Rabbi Nachman also suggested, and there are many elucidations in the teaching, that if you have the opportunity, if you have a forest by your house, if you have a river by your house, if you have a chance to get to the ocean and just watch the waves crash upon the seashore or hit against the rocks, make that a place where you're going to make your long distance. And the good news is, blessed souls, it doesn't cost you a penny to call long distance with the Most High, with your mouth and your heart and the meditations in your mind. And even if a person has reached a situation where they could be considered, according to Torah standards, the worst of the worst of human beings, and all this, so much has passed over the person, still that person is able to run to the Most High continually, and because the Most High is in every place, even in the place where that human being who has been involved in negativities, whether in speech, thought, or action, because he fills all the worlds and he encompasses all the worlds, and he is within all worlds, and everything is coming from the essence of the vitality of the Most High, may be blessed, and he actually dresses himself in all different types of scenarios to give an appearance to a human being that this is the reality that you're living in, deal with it, but there's a way to deal with it, turn to me, and turn to me as you try to deal patiently with the issues you're dealing with, and you'll see that the reaction from heaven will be you will be dealt with patiently. Dennis, your take on this teaching by Rabbi Nachman.
Well, I'll begin with a famous poem that I always liked. It was called If, by a fellow by name Robert Sill. And if anybody, even if you don't like poetry, I would recommend this poem. It's not a long one, and it's very interesting. Now I lost my train of thought, Don.
Well, there's another train coming down the track, Dennis.
Repeat the gist of what you just said, Don.
That basically a person should train him or herself to set a space
in
their mind.
Let me simply put it this way and reduce it. If you want to be a righteous person, you should see the good in almost everything.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Abraham, you're taking this, the idea of setting up, creating, so to speak, a spiritual forest in the mind where one can seclude oneself with their thoughts with the Most High, the person will be able to express his or her desire to rely solely on the Creator. I mean, still live a physical life, but a place where a person can go spiritually or even physically, as we mentioned before.
I would say for most people this is a possible avenue of comfort and ability to deal with what seems to be adversity. I will caution, however, the very obvious failure of that philosophy, in that it is only applicable to a mature human being who has the ability to intellectualize and feel and rationalize, so-called, and meditate. it does not apply, for example, to a very young, immature baby. And for that baby who may be suffering and is neurologically, intellectually unable to so-called have patience and be one with the Creator, that sort of statement fails miserably. And there's absolutely no comeback or explanation to satisfy that scenario. And so I do, you know, I understand it, but there's certainly some very significant limitations to that.
Well, I think if a person can come to grips with their limitations, as all of us are forced to in our daily lives at some level or another, then hopefully they can implement it well. And for those who can't, then they should stay away from this method.
Well, but
Ron,
the point is...
Yes, go ahead.
The very obvious scenario let's say either one of us, here we are intellectualizing and talking very comfortably on a Sunday morning. It's all very well to say, yeah, we can go and have this great meditative relationship. It does not apply to a baby here and now, millions of infants who are suffering and dying this very moment. To them, their existence for this brief period on earth is pure, unadulterated hell. And they, for them, there is no so-called salvation in that statement. That's what bothers me.
Yeah, I hear you, and yeah, I mean, and in fact, the famous story of the first and second Lubavitcher Rebbes, that the second Rebbe, the son of the first Rebbe, was deep in his studies, and one of his children fell out of his crib, and he did not hear his own child crying because he was deeply immersed in his Torah studies, while his father heard the child crying and put the child and tucked him back into bed and told his son, no matter how deep you go into your Torah learning, which is an expression of spirituality, as well as knowledge accessible by human beings, you must hear the child's cry. So, true. I mean, we're not. I do not want to give the impression of suggesting people get into his bodhidus to run away from reality, but that ultimately that type of seclusion spiritually or mentally, cognitively, should be that we should end suffering upon the earth. 1,000%. I'm part of the congregation.
Yes.
Don?
Yes.
I think Avram was also relating to the survival of humanity to a certain extent. When you're down to the basics foundation and you're just trying to survive, you get what we call animal instincts because we belong to the biological group called animals. And when you get down to the base foundation, you just try to survive. And when you're down that level, you don't open up your mind to all possibilities. You want the nearest, quickest one to end whatever is causing you a problem.
Ron, your take on these matters? Because I know you're familiar with the teachings of Rabbi Nachman.
Yes, actually I have one of his books here called Advice, and I'm on the section of patience. And this picked out one portion here. It says, a person must be at peace with himself. It is not good if different aspects of his character are in conflict with one another. He must also achieve harmony with his relationship with the outside world. Regardless of whether things are good or bad, he must always look to God for whatever happens to him. And he should not allow himself to be thrown off course by anything. He should have faith that everything he experiences day by day is a favor and a blessing. This applies even to his hardships and suffering. As I know, it's not as easy as it says here, but it's something that we should aspire to. So that's my take on, response to your question.
Okay, very good. So let's move on to, because we have about 30 minutes to go. We want to try to get in all the concepts that we talked about at the beginning of the show. Very briefly, from Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, and talking about a prophecy from Zechariah chapter 14, verse 9, quote, and God will rule over the earth. On that day God shall be one, and his name shall be one. So according to the Matsudas David, a rabbi from couple hundred years ago. This verse means that all nations will accept God and believe in him. They will no longer worship the forces of nature, not even to the extent of believing in intermediaries. Another rabbinical commentator called the Radak, Rabbi David Klimke, taught, people have many ways of referring to God, according to the perceptions of his deeds, etc. However, as the prophecy goes, on that day God will shall be one, and God's name will be one, end of quote. Since God's essence will be revealed to all, he will just be called, he will be called by just one name. Now, that name, stay tuned in the creation, blessed souls, and we shall see what that name is. Gentlemen, any commentary on this, that eventually we're going to see that the nations, and unfortunately there's still Jewish people involved in worshiping forces of nature and even going to intermediaries as opposed to just going right straight to Almighty God. Dennis?
It's our sincerest wish that all humans will be united in believing and having the faith to honor God.
Abraham?
I didn't quite get the gist of that, but I think it refers to an extension of what we were talking earlier, that ultimately mankind, humanity, will realize some similar to the along the lines of Albert Einstein that I quoted earlier, that in effect all is one, that God will be manifest in this earthly realm, and mankind will recognize God as being pervasive to our reality.
Okay, Ron?
I think we'll start tracing things back to source, and then we'll realize the source of everything is the Creator, and at that point in time we will turn to him with one voice. And we'll realize that he is one and the same as one.
Okay, beautiful. We're going to now move on to The Path of the Righteous Gentile by Rabbis Chaim Klorfin and Yaakov Rogalski. And the issue of partnership with God, meaning intermediaries, will be addressed on page 49 from the book that these two rabbis wrote. That according to many authorities, which we're talking about those who are well steeped in the oral Torah tradition, a son or daughter of Noah is not warned about the concept of partnership with God. The concept of partnership is the acknowledgement of the existence of the one true God in combination with a belief in the possibility and the existence of a deity, which they write, put in parentheses, independent will other than God. So long as ascribing power to a deity other than the Creator remains conceptual, it is permissible for the children of Noah, according to many authorities. However, the worship of this independent being is clearly idolatry. The danger of the concept of partnership is that it frees people to act in accord with non-existent gods and opens up a doorway to actual idolatry. So most recent authorities, again, well-versed in the oral Torah tradition, agree that the children are forbidden to believe in a partnership, but even according to those, the children of Noah are permitted to swear by the name of an idol in combination with God, to swear to the Lord of hosts, and say, for instance, a Hindu deity, for example. So what the gist of this is, gentlemen, and blessed souls listening out there, is that a mistaken theology is not the idolatry. The idolatry is connected to, actually, there are generally four types of general worship of idolatry, which are basically bowing down, prostrating some fully on the ground before something one's considered to be important with the Most High, offering up a sacrifice, burning incense, and I think it's also offering up like a type of libation, some sort of pouring out of a liquid, whether it be water, wine, or any other substance. So let's go around the table. Dennis, any take on this, the idea that on the one hand, people, according to the oral Torah tradition, there is a sort of permissibility to have a theological concept which is erroneous, that something is partnering with God, but at the same time, too, we want to be careful to advise people it's better not to, because they might be led to the actual bowing down or offering up an incense burning or a sacrifice or a libation to that piece of stone or that picture of someone who we think of as a God person or a God deity?
There is only one God, and there can only be one God. However, even Maimonides preached that the Trinity taught by the Catholic Church is still valid because it results in one God. In the Hindu religion that you mentioned, they have one main God, but they have two or three subsets of the same God. So the concept of God is being honored across the board in many different places. It's when we don't honor God and we honor a substitution for God that we get into trouble, because we're rationalizing, and you either accept or you reject. There is no gray area for this.
Mm-hmm.
So, let me finish also. You may have objects, but what you're doing is you're really using them to give you an intercession. An intercession means you're using them as a stepping stone to get to God. You're not honoring them. You just think that they can help you with God's favor. Now, if you're misplaced with this, that's your problem. But there still should only be one God.
Mm-hmm. Avraham, your take on this matter of, there can be tolerance for mistaken theology, but we have to also caution people that they shouldn't take that theology to an actual practice of offering up one's efforts or energies towards something which is made of the hand of mankind or something which just freely exists in nature.
Yeah, I think one has to be a little careful in saying that what we all here today are talking about is it's very easy for us to say this is what should and shouldn't be done. We speaking from admittedly a very biased perspective. And while I agree with it, I think it should be noted that there are very strong arguments about the difficulty and I don't want to go into the difficulty in establishing the relationship of God to humanity and whether or not it would be legitimate to talk about several gods. I think that by virtue of the audience that we're talking about, I don't think there's any question about any of us disagreeing. I think I should probably leave it at that.
Okay, but I see this dialogue, gentlemen and blessed souls listening out there, is to cause all of us, first and foremost, myself, I say before anyone else, and Dennis and Ron and Avram, to recalibrate our thinking just one more time. That again, how can we move one molecule, one inch forward, in a more objective perspective, as we battle with our subjective perceptions of our understandings of these Torah teachings. Ron, I know that you personally have witnessed over by the Jamaica Bay, by JFK Airport, how certain groups have offered up fruit and vegetable offerings, so to speak, to the god of the sea, which would be tantamount to some sort of idolatrous practice. What is your take on these matters, and how would you advise a Noahide to proceed step by step to freely approach the one true creator, as opposed to how they might have approached the creator in the past through intermediaries?
Okay, I have a Mishnah Torah here by the Rambam. It's called Hilchot Avodat
Kochavim?
Kochavim, correct.
Yeah.
And in this here, he basically brought out how idolatry first came into being, and the first idolaters didn't subtract the greatness or the belief in one God. What they did was they assumed that as a mortal king would be more inclined to be interested in more lofty situations of a kingdom as opposed to minor petty situations. That he would leave up to his advisors or his lords or his royal servants. So he assumed that the creator created the world, and then he left things such as the zodiac, the stars, the sun, the moon, and the forces of nature are his messengers, basically, that bring us actually bounty. And they feel that if they apply to these forces or whatever, they actually can acquire from them, because the Creator already assigned them certain roles in giving us our needs. But nevertheless, they never worship them in and of themselves as God. The problem was the latter generation. They didn't quite understand this concept, and then they started worshiping these forces as gods themselves. And this is the only problem with partnership. And Dennis mentioned before that even the Rambam says that the Trinity leads a person to believe in one God. Me, myself, being born a Catholic, also I was told that God is one God. And he has the Son and the Holy Ghost, the Holy Spirit. And I've always known that there's only one God, but nevertheless, many times you find yourself, when you're praying, you might find yourself mentioning the name of his Son even more than his name. And then there's a kind of a thing where you make it all into one, and many times this can be very confusing. And you just have to be reminded that there's only one God, and we can approach God directly without even any stepping stones many times, all the time, because he is to be approached by us. He wants us to approach him directly. And this is, I think, what partnership really is. As long as we focus and keep our mind that there is only one God, one Creator, but then, nevertheless, we can always be off course, and I think this is the fear of this partnership deal.
Okay, very good. We're now going to move into the next to last section of our humble presentations, meditations this morning, taking from the introduction to Chobos Levovos, Duties of the Heart, or the Obligations of the Heart, which, again, this is a writing which actually came before the teachings of Rambam, by Rabbeinu Bachya. And I'll read just a very brief section. We'll go around the table of discussion. So Rabbeinu Bachya teaches the following in his introduction. The wisdom of the Torah can be divided into two parts: knowledge of the duties of the organs of the body or limbs of the body, wisdom that is manifested externally, and knowledge of the duties of the heart, duties which belong to the hidden private realm of the heart. It is the wisdom of the inward life. The duties of the limbs fall into two categories. Category one, those which the intellect would have called for even if the Torah had not. For instance, hopefully the human intellect would call for us not to murder, not to steal, not to cheat, not to lie. Several examples. Number two are those duties of the limbs, those that have come to us by way of revelation, which the intellect neither insists upon nor rejects. And the duties of the heart, however, are rooted entirely in reason, as I will explain with God's help. So, let's go quickly around the table. Dennis, any commentary on this brief reading today?
Well, regardless of the categories, or the detailed categories, man must be taken, man, woman, humanity must be taken as a whole. And your mind, your body, your soul, your heart, all comes into play. And that is the entity that we're dealing with. We cannot separate it because it comes with the package. So the package is inviolate, and that's how the form, the Zelem that was created, that we are. And we must keep it that way.
True. Abraham, your take on this brief reading from Duties of the Heart.
Kind of more or less agree with the previous commentator. I think, for example, I think your quote was that it is intellectually correct to say one shouldn't lie and steal and murder, etc., etc. I think there is a great danger in assuming that that is always going to be the case, and that that is an intellectually intuitive statement. I think that if one tries to separate the components of the so-called duties into whether they intellectually innate or whether they come from a spiritual recognition, there is a certain danger. I think ultimately it is one is a union of all these, and they arise into our consciousness from a recognition of their source, which is the Creator God. And I don't think that it is correct to say they are simply intellectually always appropriate actions, because then it becomes a matter of argument of whether one is who is correct. Well, if it's intellectually appropriate for me to murder someone, so be it. I just raise that as the devil's advocate. I don't think that is a correct statement.
Avram?
Yeah, the...
Avram?
Yes, go ahead, Dennis. Go ahead, Dennis.
I'd like to say I appreciate your restraint.
Ron, any take on this before we start to vibe out on chapter 2, verse 18 in Genesis?
I'm just milling over what I heard from Avraham, and what he's saying there, it's correct, and I see that reflects many times that raising of children, when you first start trying to teach them right from wrong, they really have no understanding intellectually of why it would be wrong or right. We just instilled it in them, and as they grew older, we started giving them the intellectual nourishment that they need in cooperation with the instilling of those the directives we instill in them as children, and it tends to have more staying power because it was instilled in us prior to us even having an intellectual development. But nevertheless, as we intellectualize it later on in life, then we see many times the reasons for that, and then we see the consequences of the different actions that we take. And with that, we have a greater appreciation for it later on. And I think in Duties of the Heart, it's not so much of a separation of it. It's just of going into the detailed aspects of both the intellectual and that of emotions, which are based on the heart. Because many times we feel emotionally a certain way, but we override that intellectually because we know what the consequences of it may be. So I'm trying to put together what I've heard from lessons of Duties of the Heart and the commentary. So,
okay, well, you know, we hope to have future, readings from it, and things will get fleshed out more clearly. I'd like to move on now to, gentlemen, and blessed souls listening out there, to chapter 2, verse 18 in Genesis, where it said that, well, it says in the Torah what Moses was commanded to write down, that God said, quote, "It is not good that a human be alone. I will make for him a helper, a compatible helper for him," is one way you can read it. Now, let's note, blessed souls, that it says right here that the Most High said it wasn't good for man to be alone. So the goodness that would eventually be manifested as part of the Most High decreeing or saying that the sixth day was good, which is the day that man and woman were created, was a day where, in fact, there would be a manifestation of an element in the creation which is part and parcel of our consciousness, which is a subjective consciousness. That God had accomplished this by taking a man and taking from his rib a part of him and allowing that rib to become a fully well-developed species, which is basically the female species, as overall part of the human species. And therefore, too, now, there would be the possibility, which will eventually play out, unfortunately, to the first sin, the allure to become subjected to a knowledge of good and evil, but it should only be experienced through the subjective perceptions of man and woman. Now, in making us subjective creatures that the Most High melded together, and again, these are from oral Torah traditions from Hasidus and rabbinical commentaries and Talmudic teachings, that God put together two extremes within the human being, the human condition. The extreme of spirituality and physicality. For instance, in one instance, angels are entirely spiritual beings and do not mate. Animals can mate, on the other hand, but their drive is just a physical drive. In contrast, both the human drive into become one flesh and to propagate the species is both a spiritual one and a physical one. And a person do not, and people do not feel fulfilled unless they are coming together on both planes of spirituality and physicality. And by creating in us a spiritual, physical, heterosexual relationship, that the Most High implanted in us a perspective which we must consider, what we should consider, I humbly suggest, as inherently subjective. As opposed to other creatures, we experience life in a relational fashion, meaning theory of relativity is actually part and parcel, if we take away the theory part of it, that we relate everything in a relative basis. And therefore we come to evaluate and organize our experiences into a hierarchy of relevance, and hopefully that God will be the top of our hierarchy of relevance. So God had made for us in order that we should be able to fill a role as relative creatures with relative subjective perspectives, to subdue our subjectivity to that greater objectivity which was afforded us in the Garden of Eden, more specifically our ancestors, that we should feel the relationship between God and the creation, and therefore realize that He is on the highest point, the apex of the hierarchy of creation, and therefore we should be inspired to enhance and perfect this creation as much as we possibly can as human beings. But once the imbibing of the tree of knowledge took place, we became overwhelmed with subjectivity, and so it's a struggle for us to regain that sense of original objectivity that existed for us in the Garden of Eden. Dennis, any...
Yes, I didn't appreciate your word of the use of the word extreme. When it, to me, it sounded more natural than extreme. But be that as it may, that's just a personal choice of the words that are being used.
Okay.
Concept of having opinion necessary for the procreation of the species. When God created all the animals, He created most of them male female. There are some hermaphroditic type of animals that can create their own species without having a male female type of deal. But on the whole, most of the species need a male female. So if you're talking about the procreation of species, I mean, there's common sense involved that everybody can understand. You don't have to be a scientist. It's a miracle to recreate creation, that is, to create a baby. But it's 10 times more of a miracle that will never happen if you have the same males or females trying to create the recreation.
True, I hear you. Abraham, your take on this matter?
Well, it's complicated. I think what my take on this, the state of being, of adopting a subjective or relative view on life and on interactions, on relationships, I think that is the default state of humanity in our so-called limited capacity. I think the goal, the ideal would be, however, to transcend that state, to recognize and I wouldn't call it an objectivity. I think ultimately humanity is always going to be limited in its ability to be purely objective. But the ability to transcend subjectivity and relativity and to recognize that there is, in fact, very little difference between so-called female and male, ultimately at the subatomic energy levels. I think that ultimately is an ideal to aspire towards. However, in our practical day-to-day existence in this earthly realm, we do depend on having the ability to be subjective and to take a relative view of life, and that's just the nature of our life in this existence.
True. true. I just want to accent what you just mentioned, Avram, is that there is a teaching I once saw from Rabbi Nachman that by tzaddikim, and I wish upon all of us to reach this level of consciousness, that they get to a point where they go beyond looking at whether a person is a male or a female. They just see human beings with divine image. And that's, I think most of us have our moments where we can get to that level, but because we are enclosed in very corporeal bodies, we fall prey to our animal tendencies to associate a person according to the way they look, as opposed to, you know, the inner design of the person. Ron, your take on these matters, going back to the Garden of Eden.
A thought that came to me while listening is that when God said it was not good for man to be alone, I felt it's not good for man to be incomplete, because the creation of Eve also allowed Adam to become complete in terms of your ability to create and to become co-creators with the Creator, actually. And I think that brings the completion of man. And she is opposite to him in terms of her physical arrangement. But nevertheless, they are complete units. And I think that what this teaches us here is to aspire towards completeness. And not only in physical, but in the spiritual realm. And that's one of the reasons why when I think, you know, couples get married over the years, they don't look at each other in the same way any longer. And they become more of a mental and spiritual partnership than the initial physical partnership they had initially when they first met. I think that that point in time is where the completeness really takes effect, where it's not only a physical, but a spiritual, a mental, not only mental, but a spiritual completeness between the two. That's my my initial thing on this few seconds ago.
I like what you're saying, Ron. And gentlemen, you know, we normally go about an hour and a half. We've gone almost 2 hours. We've got about 3 minutes to go. So I'm going to just sign off by saying, first of all, I profusely thank all of you, Dennis Ryan and Rav Avraham and Ron Williams, for taking what is your valuable time. I mean, outside of the Most High, the most valuable commodity we have in our lives is the time that we use. And I profusely thank all of you gentlemen for coming on today to vibe out with me. And Dennis, would you like to say any conclusive statements in 30 seconds or so?
Yes. May the Lord be with you. May you make the right decisions and have a happy heart.
Amen. Avram?
I wish you, the co-hosts, and everyone listening a blessed week, and may this week bring us closer to the knowledge of our Creator.
Amen. Ron?
We should all have inner and outer peace. And thanks a million for having me on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure and honor to have you on. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to try. Hopefully we won't get into this very annoying feedback. I'm going to try to play a song with Let His Name Be One by Blessed Brother David Dohm. And if we do get static feedback, we'll just abruptly end the show. I want to remind everyone, please, blessed souls out there, do not overestimate the negative traits that you have, and don't underestimate the goodness within you, because ultimately we are all good, because we were created by the one, by the one whose nature is to do good. He did us a great good to bring us into this creation. And this Creator who did good, Let His Name Be One by David Dohm, Ahava Chad, one love, Goral Echad, one destiny, Kulana for all of us, Badarchi Shalom, in a peaceful way, Darchi Noam, in a pleasant way. Take care, everyone.
Well.
Bless his souls. Guess what? At the the song went off because I had to click it off because I found out the source of the distorted feedback. Anyway, we'll just wish everyone a happy week. And again, may the Most High bless all of us. to join that uniformed and unified forest of universal human consciousness, and we should weed out the trees of contention with our own mini forest to become unified in the true unified forest of the human family condition. Take care, everyone.
Be well.